Welcome to WISO Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, new series abound. We've got reports from several of WISO's new series, including Bulletin Board Diaries, Senior Voices, and Scratch Innovation. All of these community-focused programs started on WISO in just the last month. Up first, from our latest series beginning this week, called County Lines, a series which focuses on small towns and rural communities in the Miami Valley and beyond, where Community Voices producer Renee Wild will travel up and down the highways and back roads to bring WISO listeners stories of country life that go beyond the stereotypes. In the first report, across the U.S., a growing number of rural communities are facing a growing veterinarian shortage that is expected to worsen in the coming years. These regions are in need of veterinarians that specialize in livestock animals and public practice. To combat this growing problem, the American Veterinary Medical Association is trying to encourage more veterans to practice in underserved areas with the help of a loan repayment program. It provides veterinarians up to $75,000 in loan repayment in exchange for serving at least 3 years in a federally designated shortage area. In this report, producer Wild rides along with a country veterinarian to talk about that shortage.
I'm sitting in the passenger seat of the pickup truck that serves as the mobile office for veterinarian Dr. Scott Hoskett.
I don't know, have you ever seen a calf being castrated?
Can't say that I have, but for Dr. Hoskett, this is a routine farm call.
Yeah, I graduated from Ohio State College of Veterinary Medicine in 1978, and then I went to Wisconsin. Well, I was up there from 78 to 81, then I moved back here to Ohio.
Dr. Hoskett is considered a mixed animal practice vet, which means that he divides his time between treating small animals like dogs and cats in his clinic and traveling between farms, like this afternoon, to treat large animals that range from horses, cows, goats, pigs, and llamas.
So typically it's small animal surgery from 8 to 10, and then I like to leave space open for large animal, but I'll have small animal from 11 to noon, and then in the afternoon I'll have like 2 to 3 hours of large animal and 2 hours of a small. So I try to finish up at 6 o'clock, but invariably, you know, I end up getting called out after 6.
We get to the first farm, and Dr. Hoskett opens the covered truck bed, gathering up everything he needs for the procedure. Most of the equipment is easily recognizable. Syringes, bandages, stethoscope. But there's a whole pile of specially large animal tools that look more like something you might find in a hardware store. When we enter the barn for that castration procedure, the steer is tightly enclosed in a metal holding pen so that he can't move around and hurt himself. Or us.
I'm going to look the other way.
The soon-to-be former steer surges against the pen as Dr. Hoskett works with the efficiency of a man who's been doing this for the past 40 years. The entire procedure takes less than 10 minutes, and we're back in the truck and on to the next farm call. In addition to these scheduled farm visits, Dr. Hoskett also does emergency calls for large animals, which typically happen after office hours, especially during the winter months when most livestock are having their babies.
The one time from January to March, I spent, it was like 13 hours a day. I didn't even eat dinner with my family for, I think it was 110 days. There's some nights about once a month, every couple months, I'm so exhausted that I just, at 11 o'clock, I just turn my phone off.
Okay, that right there is one of the reasons that new veterinarians don't want to go into large animal practice.
There is a shortage of large animal vets. That's what I tell people. There's a shortage at 2 o'clock in the morning. Some of them do not want to work over 40 hours a week. They don't want to do emergencies. Plus, they're coming out with $160,000 debt.
In Ohio, 29 counties located in the southern parts of the state are feeling the vet shortage. And 9 of those counties have no veterinarian practices. We arrive at our second farm call to treat a pet goat named Jackson.
Well, it was about 9 years ago when you were here, so.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm glad you're not retired.
No.
What would you do if you had been retired?
Boy, I don't know who I would have called.
Yeah.
Really? A lot of them don't like to come out anymore.
Dr. Hoskett is turning 65 this year, but he has no intention of retiring anytime soon.
I do enjoy it still, but it is getting harder and it's getting real tiring. And the other night, I had a dog that really took a bad turn, wasn't responding to any treatment, and I actually brought it in the house. It bothered me so much, I only got about 2 hours sleep. I kept waking up and checking on the dog. It ended up passing away. And I think the day comes, if it doesn't bother me, a pet dying, if it doesn't bother me that much, then that might be the time. When the time comes, I'm going to quit cold turkey. I'll have a sign on my door, gone fishing.
And when the time does come for him to hang up his gone fishing sign, hopefully a new generation will be there to continue his work. For County Lines on WYSO, Renee Wild, Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Kane went running after deer, wasn't scared of jumping off the truck in high gear. Kane went a sniffing and he would go, was the best old hound dog I ever did know. I had a dog and his name was Kane. I told the dog about it.
WYSO's newest series, County Lines. It's made possible in part by a generous grant from the Ohio Humanities. In central Ohio, law enforcement have seen an increase in sex trafficking, likely due to the opioid epidemic. The demand for this work is driven by men who seek sex. While criminal justice plays a big role in curbing that demand, reporter Esther Honig of Side Effects Public Media asks the question if education or punishment is more effective.
It's a dreary Saturday morning at the downtown courthouse. A group of around 20 men sit in a conference room, arms crossed, eyes staring blankly at the presenter.
But I know you guys don't want to be here. This is probably the last thing you want to be doing on a Saturday morning. I completely get that.
This is John School. Everyone here was caught purchasing sex. Some were ordered here while others chose to come in exchange for a lighter sentence.
Coercion. What do you guys think coercion might be?
Many of these students believed that women enjoy sex work, but what they're learning is that the majority are forced into it as victims of human trafficking.
So, hello everyone. My name is Jen. I have 2.5 years sober.
Jen Glasser was driven to sex work by an opioid addiction.
How I got started, my son's father introduced me to heroin, went through everything. I lost my home, I lost my son. I had nothing. The only way I could make money was to prostitute.
Eventually, she was trafficked by a man she thought was her boyfriend and nearly died before she managed to escape.
If you're out there looking for love, it's not going to happen. Because, you know, I told you I loved you. I told you I'd marry you. I told you anything you wanted to hear just so I can get that money. That's all you got. That's all it was about.
At least a few men in this room appear to really be listening, and the idea is that this will discourage them from ever buying sex again. Some studies show John School works. Others say it's inconclusive. Policy expert Alex Trudeau says what's been proven is the shame and embarrassment of getting arrested. That alone reduces recidivism by 70%.
So in my mind, anything else you get on top of that with a John School or a fine or whatever is gravy. The key is, are you actually making the arrest?
But making the arrest takes time and resources. Ron Kimmerling is the commander of the Vice Unit with Columbus Police. And to catch sex buyers, he sets up what are called reverse stings out of hotels and out on the streets. A female officer poses as a prostitute while several more officers stand by as backup.
If you go out there, you'll see these guys circling the block. They're like a shark. It's patently obvious what they're doing. The people in the neighborhood know what they're doing.
It's a labor-intense job. Kimmerling points out the cost of these operations may be greater than the penalty. Columbus laws allow a fine up to $1,000 and 30 days in jail, but few men do any time. An analysis of court records by Side Effects shows that in the last 2 years, the average for fines was around $70.
Myself, speaking personally, I wonder about priorities when a traffic fine costs more than picking up a woman for sex in Columbus.
Kimmerling and advocates think a harsher penalty will discourage men from doing this in the first place. A state lawmaker has introduced a bill that would increase the fine to $2,000, with half of the money going to help victims of sex trafficking. Alex Trouteau says how the fine gets used is more important than the amount. If it goes towards a fund to help victims, judges are more likely to impose it, and it holds the sex buyer accountable.
You know, there's just a long history in our country of finding ways to excuse men who buy sex illegally.
Of course, those with the most at stake here are the victims. Another survivor, Valerie, asks that we not use her full name. She thinks John School alone is the most effective solution.
I think it's a sickness. I think that they're spiritually bankrupt, and there's underlying issues with this.
If this is their chance to reflect and learn from their mistakes, Valerie's hoping they'll take it. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Esther Honig.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. You can find more reports on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks again for joining us. In the age of online advertising, some people still use the old school method to promote stuff they want to buy or sell or services they're offering by posting on bulletin boards in laundromats, restaurants, and other places. In the series Bulletin Board Diaries, we bring you some of the stories behind those advertisements. Today, a business card found on a bulletin board at a Lebanon restaurant takes us to a horse barn in Franklin.
Here we go.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Christina.
Christina. Jerry.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Inside the barn in Franklin, stalls run the length of both sides. In one stall, three tiny baby goats announce their presence while huddling together in a pile of hay. On the other side of the barn are the two horses that Christina Green is here to see. Christina is a farrier specializing in what's called barefoot trimming. That means she cares for the hooves of horses who don't wear iron horseshoes. She also cares for donkeys, mules, and small livestock animals. Farriers as a profession have been organized for about 700 years. One of the horses Christina will work on today is Hank, a big brown horse with hooves the size of dinner plates.
Okay. Hi, Hank. Good boy. So Hank is a draft horse.
Beautiful.
Yep. And he is 25 years old, so they just got a couple months ago, and he's still trying to gain weight. That's why he looks the way he does.
Oh, okay.
Hank is essentially a rescue horse. He should weigh about 2,000 pounds, but when his new owners found him, he was at least 500 pounds underweight.
Okay, now Hank is almost completely blind, and was it right eye, I believe? So sometimes he wants to walk around and do things. I have to let him know I am here.
Starting with one of Hank's back legs, Christina begins her work.
So you just kind of ask them for their leg by touching it, petting it, reassuring them you're not going to yank on them and make them fall over. Hang up. Hang up. Like that.
Good boy. Okay, easy. Stand.
Once Hank is ready, Christina places his leg hoof side up in a sturdy metal stand. She cleans and trims the frog. That's the triangular center of the hoof. Then she trims and balances the hoof wall and file finishes the bottom and side edges. Christina is basically giving Hank a supersized mani-pedi, but what she's doing is actually more about the horse's health than making his hooves look nice.
Hoof down. Everyone. He's like, nope. Not today.
Horse hooves are made from a tough protein called keratin, the same material that human nails and hair are made of. The hooves grow, and so they need to be trimmed and kept even to prevent balance issues. The hooves also carry a lot of weight and need to be kept healthy.
Wild horses do not have to have their hooves trimmed because they do it themselves. They travel about 25 miles a day. They don't have to worry about human interference helping them.
Christina is 27 years old. Her long, wavy blonde hair is pulled back in a ponytail. In blue jeans and a sweater, she also sports thick rubber boots and a pink apron. Not the kitchen variety. This apron is more like the chaps worn by bull riders. On her hands, a pair of tough leather gloves.
Good boy. Good.
Christina likes to talk to the animals as she works. She says it helps keep them calm.
It shows that someone actually cares.
Hank's trimming takes a while because of his age and past neglect. A foul smell emanates from an infected hoof as Christina cleans out the dirt and other debris. She tells me it's improved since her last visit, but it's clearly still causing Hank distress.
Bearing down today.
The horse pulls his leg back, knocking over the stand, defiantly stomping his hoof in protest.
Oh, whoa. Good boy.
Christina comforts Hank and deftly continues with her job.
It's a lot of work. It really is. I mean, if you don't mind being dirty or being kicked or coming home smelling like horses, it's a great job. It's not going to faint a heart, though.
This career path has come as a bit of a surprise for Christina, who says she didn't grow up on a farm and only started riding horses at the age of 20. She learned the farrier trade after getting a horse of her own and has been doing the work for about 6 years.
The most I've ever trimmed one day, which I regret, is 15. 15 full horses. It's a lot of work, and you're just a leave, a hot shower, 10 hours of sleep, and you should be fine, but sometimes it takes more than a day to rebound from it.
Christina currently cares for roughly 160 animals and says she develops a close bond with most of them.
I really care about my horses that I trim. They're not mine, but I try to get to know them. So every horse has their own strengths and weaknesses, their own personality. And sometimes you become attached, even though they're not yours. It's like, worst part about being a farrier, you get a call saying the horse passed away.
With Hank and Joe back in their stalls, Christina packs up her tools and sits down on the barn floor. In a notebook, she writes down the condition of the horses she spent time with, notes the work she performed, and schedules her next visit. She'll be back in about 6 weeks to do this all over again. For WYSO's Bulletin Board Diaries, I'm Jerry Kenney. To see a photo of the original bulletin board ad, Christina Green, and the horses she cares for, visit us at WYSO.org. Shirley Horner grew up on Shannon Avenue in the 1940s, back when West Carrollton was more rural. Today on Senior Voices, Shirley reminisces about her loving grandmother and the important role she played in her young life. She shared her story with Dayton Metro Library volunteer Nancy Messer.
My grandmother was the stability in my life, actually, in lieu of the fact that my parents were very young. I think my dad was 19 and my mother was 17. And then my dad went off to war soon, not too long after. And so they didn't have a very good or close relationship. So my grandmother was my stay. She was my rock. And I loved her dearly. And that part of it made it very good. She liked me best, too, I think. They live right across the field here. I'm looking out, and the house is torn down now. Then my mother moved up just on the same block. I lived in one of those kind of shotgun houses here on Shannon Avenue. I went every morning to her house because she was so concerned I would not like my lunch. And she would pack me a boiled ham sandwich or some cheese and crackers just in case, so I had to always go there before I went to school. I loved her dearly. She died when she was only 57, and she worked hard and too hard. And the day she died, she had been over in the field picking dandelions. It was November, and she had bent over so long, and it takes forever to pick a kettle of dandelions to make. They cook them, and it's almost like spinach. And she was chopping wood to put those dandelions on her wood stove to cook, and she had a cerebral hemorrhage. And that was the end of my grandma, and it was almost the end of me. She was still had that hatchet in her hand when she fell to the ground. But all of it was good, but I was just young, and it was very difficult for me to give her up. They stayed together. My grandmother stayed in spite of everything, and she taught them a standard. And I think even if it wasn't learned, you can look and see if your family, you know, what they need, where you need to be. People know in their own heart what's good and not good. And just being strong enough to stay with the good, make a purpose in your life to do well and excel and leave a good report.
That was 79-year-old West Carrollton resident Shirley Horner speaking with Nancy Messer as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices podcaster Patty Garrett. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Del Mar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. A century ago, Dayton helped drive the global economy with inventions that changed the world. Think the airplane, the cash register, the self-starting engine. In one of WISO's newest series, Scratch, reporters ask, where is that spirit of invention still alive and well? Today, producer Jess Mador takes us inside an event aimed at helping aspiring entrepreneurs realize their business dreams.
The big players in Dayton's tech and innovation scene include household and not-so-household names. The Air Force Research Lab, the University of Dayton Research Institute, Procter & Gamble. But what about regular people with a good business idea or invention but not a lot of money? How easy is it for them to get their ideas off the ground?
One of the best questions I've ever heard and something that I've been frustrated with in Dayton for the last 10 years.
Rocky Belcher is a professor of entrepreneurship at Sinclair Community College. Despite Dayton's reputation for innovation, he says there's not a lot of financing out there for entrepreneurs with mom-and-pop-sized ideas.
There seems to be enough investment for the next great thing that has a 1 in 1,000 chance of actually being something. There's very little out there for people who have a good small business idea.
I meet Belcher at one of a growing list of events in the city aimed at helping entrepreneurs turn their ideas into reality. This one happens every month at Third Perk Coffee House and Wine Bar in downtown Dayton. It's called The Percolator.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
So, welcome to The Percolator. I am Juanita Michelle, owner of Third Perk Coffee House and Wine Bar and Third Perk Express. I'm also an assistant professor at Sinclair Community College where I teach mathematics. So go Tartans, and welcome to all you guys here.
MC Darden, who goes by Juanita Michelle, created The Percolator. Aspiring entrepreneurs get just 90 seconds to stand up in front of an audience and pitch their ideas to a special panel of judges. Usually, it's a mix of people with real-world business expertise. Juanita Michelle has started a few businesses of her own, including the Third Perk coffee chain. Tonight, she's also serving as a judge.
So I'm going to let the wonderful women who are here to support you and to give you great feedback introduce themselves, and then we'll get started with the first panelist.
I am Kiana Avery, founder and owner of a boutique PR firm that offers PR and marketing services.
And I am Lakeisha Grant. I am the publisher of Ambition Magazine, dedicated to small businesses, entrepreneurs. It is honestly built to promote you.
Let me know when you're ready.
And the pitching begins. One by one, five brave would-be entrepreneurs stand up in front of the room.
I am the owner-operator of a Potter's Muse LLC.
I have a platform called Curified to make subscription revenue from sharing digital content.
I've been an auto mechanic since I was 14 years old. We are going to be female-run, female-owned, and cater to women.
Each business is at a different stage of development. Juanita Michelle keeps things moving with a timer.
So our last participant is Jimmy Donald.
My business is Man Around the House Maintenance, all basic small maintenance to remodeling, specializing in bathrooms.
Jimmy tells the judges he started the home repair business after hitting a rough patch in his life.
I moved here to Dayton from Michigan after serving a few years in a Michigan correctional facility, and I was living in a van with my dog.
The minister in training is also motivated by a deeper need to give back, and that's what led him to pitch at tonight's Percolator.
Unbreakable Soul Enterprises is what it's called. The bigger plan of Unbreakable Soul Enterprises is finding young brothers who have come from where I come from, finding their skill set, and building a business around them.
Jimmy's banking on a hope that spending time with African-American male role models could also help struggling young men avoid incarceration in the future. Jimmy finishes his pitch. Judge Lakeisha Grant gets emotional.
I'm extremely interested in Unbreakable Souls because almost every male in my family has been incarcerated. So I just want to encourage you to see if you can become a part of the system in a positive way so that these young men can go through you, be mentored, and begin to make money.
I just want to show guys that came from where I came from that you can be on a level playing field. You just got to work a little harder, but that's what it is.
Everybody was awesome today.
And with that, the Percolator winds down. Last year, the Percolator heard pitches from more than two dozen people in Dayton. Tonight's participants will have the opportunity to move on to the so-called Dreamers Gala. It's an annual fundraising event Juanita Michelle launched in 2015 to support budding entrepreneurs. To qualify, participants must submit a detailed business plan. Outside, Sinclair Professor Rocky Belcher says that's the kind of preparation it takes for entrepreneurs to make it in business.
Everyone has an idea. Ideals don't really cut it. In this world, you have to actually show the banker that you're thinking 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, not just what am I going to do the day that I open.
Even with preparation, Belcher says, the odds are steep. Data show the average entrepreneur has just a 1 in 5 chance of success.
And another Scratch Series report this week detailed how more and more Americans are using technology such as LED light bulbs and programmable smart thermostats to save on utility bills. Now researchers are working on technology to make buildings even more energy efficient. Jess Mador visited one new facility near the University of Dayton that could help revolutionize the way we heat and cool our homes, offices, and other spaces in the future.
Inside a two-story gray house near the University of Dayton campus, all the lights are on. There's a large flat-screen television on the wall, a leather sofa decorated with colorful throw pillows.
All the furnishings here are from IKEA.
Rajan Rajendran decorated this house himself, down to the smallest detail.
Refrigerator, oven, dishwasher, range, microwave. And this here is the dining room.
This 2,000-square-foot suburban-style house could be found in almost any city across the United States, except for one unusual feature, skinny metal poles running from floor to ceiling in every room.
Temperature and humidity and pressure sensors and carbon dioxide sensors.
No one actually lives here. The house is a science experiment. It's part of the recently opened Helix Innovation Center in Dayton. The 40,000-square-foot Helix building was the brainchild of St. Louis-based Emerson Company. It's a multi-billion-dollar company with a global footprint, including in heating and cooling systems.
Whether you shop Whole Foods or Kroger, Meijer, they all provide the food to you that are kept cold using Emerson equipment.
Mechanical engineer Rajendran runs the Helix.
And when we collect data using sensors, we try to figure out what that data means.
The ultimate goal, he says, is creating something that's hard to put your finger on, human comfort.
And people ask me, did you go overboard? Why do you need a big TV? Why is that important? Because at the end of the day, there's a lot of heat that's coming out of these devices, and they do affect your comfort.
Rajendran's research includes cutting-edge efficiency technology that can measure all this heat, humidity, pressure, and other elements, and automatically regulate the temperature of different rooms. And scientists are also recreating the exterior of the home. The house is built inside a giant climate-controlled hangar sealed with heavy doors. Rajendran says giant heaters and air conditioners can simulate the sun's effect, so scientists can study its energy performance on a single day in such far-flung locations as Alaska, Arizona, or Mississippi.
Go all the way down to minus 30, or we can go up to 130.
It's the sort of real-time research that experts say often drags on for years. So by simulating a full year's worth of weather conditions in just about a week, Emerson is speeding the time it takes for an idea to become a product in stores or on the factory floor.
We're looking at where we can have the most impact for the average person living in an average home, doing average things, living in an average building. That's why this building is 40,000 square feet.
And the house is just one of 6 different simulated ecosystems inside the Helix. There's also a grocery store, an industrial cooling system powerful enough to chill an entire Budweiser factory, a commercial kitchen that even serves food a few times a week, and the Helix office building itself is also a data-producing, climate-controlled bubble.
This is truly a unique facility. There is no other facility like this.
And they've already filed 2 patents and launched an entire new product off that.
The Dayton Development Coalition's Mitch Heaton says since the Helix opened a year and a half ago, it's also allowed Emerson to meet federal EPA energy targets ahead of schedule.
To look at the future of ice machines working more efficiently and wasting less water and wasting less energy.
And that could be a really big deal. Commercial and residential buildings account for more than 70% of electricity used in the U.S. and more than 40% of carbon dioxide emissions, a major contributor to climate change. And because of Emerson's massive size, University of Dayton engineering professor Kevin Hallinan says the Helix has the potential to help reduce energy consumption worldwide.
The intelligence built into these systems can really help manage energy consumption to reduce it while also maintaining comfort when people need that comfort seamlessly, where they don't even know that they're doing it.
But Hallinan points out new technology alone can't solve the energy problem. Up to around half the energy used in the typical home has to do with human behavior, not technology. The next step, Hallinan says, is to test whether the Helix's energy efficiency performance can be replicated outside the tightly controlled lab environment.
Because ultimately, it needs to be proved that the work that the Helix is doing has value in the world also.
Emerson has already started doing this. The company's partnered with UD to build 50 occupied research homes on campus. And collecting enough energy consumption data will take a year of real-life heating and cooling seasons. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
And I'm Jerry Kenny for WYSO Weekend. Those last two reports are part of WYSO's Scratch Innovation Series. To see photos of the Helix, visit our website, WYSO.org. And any ideas about innovation you have, leave us a voicemail at 769-1374. We may use your story on the air. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.